Once again, thank you very much for giving up the time to share these reflections. Last night, I sketched out some of the features which the first Christian centuries saw as most important in the life of prayer and growth in the Spirit. And I underlined the way in which the sense of standing where Jesus stands, so that Jesus himself can pray in you, became central to people's thinking. Also, the close connection between prayer and the work of reconciliation and justice, and the notion of fidelity, staying put and seeing things through, as crucial to the enterprise, and as symbolized in the use, the faithful and steady use, of a kind of short formula that just kept your mind anchored in God. I'm now going to do what I've always deplored in textbook church histories and jump forward 1,000 years. It shouldn't be allowed, but unfortunately, 3 nights is just 3 nights. And I'm going to speak tonight about some of the writers of the 16th and 17th centuries on both sides of the Reformation divide. It's surprising how much there is a sort of common agenda between reformers and Catholics in that era, and I hope by the end of this evening you may see why there's a kind of convergence there. Because both the reformers and the Catholic reformers of the 16th century who reacted against the Reformation, both groups were reacting against some aspects of the prayer and piety of the late Middle Ages. By the end of the 15th century, late medieval religion had split into 3 different sorts of constituencies. First of all, there was the hyperactive, very colourful, rather over-exuberant popular religion that basically paid for most of what is around us here this evening. The world of pilgrimage and devotion and indulgences and all sorts of things which made life tremendously enjoyable for the late medieval person in the street. To get a sense of what late medieval religion in England was like, you'd now have to go to India, I think, and visit a Hindu temple. All this tasteful plain glass and unpainted stone would not have been what it looked like in the Middle Ages. There would have been bright colours everywhere and completely tasteless decorations, a great deal of noise and a great deal of smell, and a good time had by all. Exactly how it connected to carrying the cross of Jesus Christ was a bit of an issue for some people in the church. And so you have the 2 other bits of that late medieval map. You have people who emphasize sobriety and good behavior and Bible reading. This is before the Reformation, mind you. People like Thomas a Kempis, who wrote The Great Imitation of Christ, where the emphasis is on systematic self-examination, carefully monitoring how you behave, how you speak, praying soberly and carefully, remembering you've got to give an account of yourself to God. Very moral, very self-denying, and not a great deal of colour in it at all. But almost at the other end of the spectrum, the 3rd bit of the map, is the world of those who practiced contemplative prayer, especially in Germany and what's now Holland and Belgium. The group often called the Rhineland mystics, for obvious reasons. And they lay huge emphasis on the themes that you find in the Greek fathers. God can't be known. God is deeply mysterious. We have to hollow out our insides to nothingness before God can come and take up residence in us. Great emphasis on darkness, on what one writer calls the trackless path, the desert path, in German, ohne Wege. There are no paths, no tracks. You just go into this deep, dark mystery of God. And getting a bit of a grasp on all of those aspects of late medieval religion helps us to understand something of what was going on in the Reformation. Martin Luther finally exploded in fury against the world of popular devotion, basically saying, this is simply an attempt to buy God off. It's doing lots and lots of interesting, enjoyable, and useful things so that you can be sure that God's on your side. And for Luther, that's just paganism at the end of the day. The true God for Luther is precisely the God of the German mystics. His face is hidden. Left to ourselves, we have only terror, deep dread before God. There's no way we can get round him, persuade him of anything. There's no way in which we can manipulate him or negotiate with him. And then the great breakthrough is to realize that in spite of this, he is God for us and with us. And for Luther, unless you at some point understand that sense of hellish, despairing terror before God, you haven't even begun. The early Luther, the younger Luther in particular, can be quite a frightening writer when he gets his teeth into this subject. And it reflects his own bitter, terrifying experience as a young monk, where he was doing all the right things, pressing all the right buttons, and still, basically, terrified out of his wits by the thought of a God completely out of his control and out of his understanding. The miracle is when you come to understand that that dark and hidden God is love. But unless you start with Luther in hell, you won't get to heaven. He's very fierce about people who expect prayer to give you nice experiences. One thing Luther is not about is nice experiences and spiritual highs. And very interestingly, Luther put together a kind of anthology of some of the mystical writing of the late Middle Ages for the use of German-speaking people. The Theologia Germanica, or Deutsche Theologie, is a sort of basic layperson's guide to the principles of going out into the darkness to meet God. And curiously, you find just a bit of the same thing in John Calvin, the other great giant of the European Reformation. Calvin has a very bad name in history, rather like St. Augustine, only worse. But if you read Calvin's sermons on growing up in the spiritual life, you'll see some very profound things. And there's a long sermon of his on the Abraham and Isaac story, which of course comes up again and again in Christian philosophy over the centuries. Abraham is commanded by God to sacrifice Isaac, and he obeys. And Calvin says this means that at every point in our Christian journey as we grow up, we have to sacrifice our faith. Well, that's a very bizarre thing to say, isn't it? You can see the Daily Mail headline, leading theologian says we have to sacrifice our faith. But what he means is the faith that is just ours, the faith that suits me, is something that has to be slaughtered over and over again. Because we're always reducing God to the proportions of our expectation, our comfort zone. So the Isaac, the beloved child of the story, is our beloved spiritual life, which we cuddle to ourselves and won't let go of. And God is always saying, let go, because that's not me. So there are some quite difficult and sobering themes coming up in the European Reformation. And we'll see in a moment some of what is happening on the Catholic side as well, because, perhaps not surprisingly, much of the same material is bubbling up there. But before moving on, let's just have a look for a moment at what was happening in the English Reformation. Perhaps here even more than on the continent, the abolition of the monasteries was a very significant fact. And it wasn't all negative. Now, from many points of view, the abolition of monasteries in England was traumatic and disastrous, it was violent and horrible. But some of the preachers and writers of the period do make something of this that's not entirely negative. And what they do is something like this. Once upon a time, Christian people thought, prayer, oh, we have monks to do that for us. Well, what do you do when there aren't any monks? The answer is, sadly, you've got to do it yourself. Everybody now needs to be committed to the same seriousness about prayer that once belonged just to monks and nuns. Every Christian household, every Christian family is a little monastery. And I think a little mischievously, one or two of the English reformers go back to the early church and pick up a couple of stories from the monastic literature of the early church, where this or that great monk has a vision telling him that actually he's not doing any better than a pious person who lives in the world. So there we are, QED, say the reforming preachers. There's nobody to do it for you. It's over to you now. Every man his own monk, so to speak, and woman his her own nun. Now, one result of this is to produce a kind of devotion in the English Reformation which emphasizes very strongly praying at all points during the day. And there are lots of little books of prayer in the 16th century that tell you what to say when you get up, what to say when you're having breakfast, what to say when you go to work, what you do at lunchtime. You know, your prayer life extends steadily through the day. And it's not, I think to us it can perhaps sound a bit mechanical, but I don't think it felt like that in the 16th century. It was a way of allowing everybody to bring everyday experiences, domestic experiences, into their prayer. Part of the great Reformation vision that God genuinely was interested in all of your life and all of your experience, and that religious practice wasn't a hobby. So, lots of manuals of prayer for the day, lots of emphasis on sanctifying every action, and not very much explicit interest at first sight in what you might call contemplation, in the prayer of silence and receptivity that's so important in the early fathers and in much Catholic thought. But when you've said that, that's not the whole truth. The emphasis in many writers on thanksgiving, and remember how some of the early Christian writers say, thanksgiving is your doorway to contemplation. That's when you just look at God for what he is, not just for what he does. That's the point also where some of the reformers bring in some of these notions of just gazing on God and absorbing his goodness. Here's John Bradford, who was martyred by Queen Mary in 1555. Though I want here, I have riches there. Though I hunger here, I shall have fullness there. Though I faint here, I shall be refreshed there. This is the city promised to the captives whom Christ shall make free, the kingdom assured to them whom Christ shall crown. There is the world that shall never wax worse. There is every want supplied freely, no danger, but happiness and honour and singing and praise and thanksgiving unto the heavenly Jehovah, with whom I shall reign after I have run this comfortless race. That very beautiful passage from a little work called A Sweet Contemplation of Heaven shows how some of that delight in God's glory and beauty for its own sake comes through, even in the most Protestant and functionalist writers. And Edwin Sands, who became Archbishop of York under Queen Elizabeth, has some similar things to say, where again he sees thanksgiving as the climax of prayer. We must acknowledge every good and perfect gift cometh down from above, and is by his mercy freely given. It's the doorway into the understanding of God for God's own sake, as you might say. And rather like Origen, Archbishop Sands underlines the fact that you can pray anywhere, at any time, in any words. When, where, and how to pray? When? Always, without ceasing. Where? In all places, especially that place which, being sanctified to this use, is therefore called the house of prayer. So this is an approach to prayer devoted to the idea that you can sanctify ordinary experience, that you can, if you like, lift up the whole Christian community to the level of monastic devotion by regular rhythms of prayer through the day. It's a view of prayer which sees it certainly as appropriate to the house of prayer, but also to the domestic context. And that connects again with a very important lay focus. An otherwise rather unknown writer called John Norden, a layman of Queen Elizabeth's reign, has some wonderful reflections on prayer in this way, saying, "You can't pray if you're too attached to your worldly comforts or your worldly anxieties. If you've got too much in the way of possessions, prayer's going to be difficult." Origen, once again. He, like the early Christians, says the most important thing is that you keep crying, "Abba, Father," to God. And he adds, "Do it whenever you like, at all times." In the same vein, Bishop Henry King of Chichester, in the 17th century, writing again on the Lord's Prayer, says the great thing about prayer, especially the Lord's Prayer, is that it takes you back to paradise. The dignity, the glory and beauty that Adam lost by his sin is restored to you in prayer. When you pray in Jesus Christ and say, "Our Father," you're doing what Adam was created to do and what he stopped doing when he ate the apple. So there's a wonderful vision there of prayer as a kind of restoring of the order of creation as it's meant to be. And Bishop King has some very eloquent words. Again, forgive me if I just quote one or two. "Christ, having now by grace restored to man what originally he lost, purchased the title of son by adoption. Since that we took from creation was extinct, he held it meetest that as God now took us for his children, we should also in our prayers claim him for our Father. So, beginning where Adam left, and directing our supplications to that Father which first made us." Back to Eden. Back to paradise. And I think that's part of the theological background of one of the greatest poems of the 17th century, which you'll see in your service order for tonight, George Herbert's poem, Prayer. "Prayer, the church's banquet, angels' age, God's breath in man returning to his birth, the soul in paraphrase, heart in pilgrimage, the Christian plummet sounding heaven and earth, engine against the Almighty, sinner's tower, reversed thunder, Christ's side-piercing spear, the 6 days' world transposing in an hour, a kind of tune which all things hear and fear. Softness and peace and joy and love and bliss, exalted manner, gladness of the best, heaven in ordinary, man well dressed, the Milky Way, the bird of paradise, church bells beyond the stars heard, the soul's blood, the land of spices, something understood. We could spend all night on that alone, preferably with nobody talking about it. But that astonishing pile-up of images rests on something of that vision that Bishop King sets out. This is creation restored, and creation, so to speak, raised beyond anything we can imagine in beauty, the bird of paradise. And it's the soul's blood, it's the life of renewed identity in Christ. And it's God's breath in man returning to his birth. It's God's gift, God's breathing out of the Spirit into us, bringing us into Christ's identity, returning to the source. And then it's that penetration and absorption beyond words, something understood. George Herbert's poems always end with a phrase that it takes you years to think about. That's just one of them. Well, a quick channel crossing once again, because it's time now to turn to the Catholic world of this era. And that's a world in which rather more systematic work is going on about the methods of praying and the stages of prayer. And there's quite a variety of approaches. Remember that in this period, the Jesuit order is being founded by Saint Ignatius, a great Spaniard who, after a military career, rather disastrous military career, decided to start a completely new kind of religious order and got a few friends together in Rome and got approval for a quite new kind of religious order, not a monastic order, no sort of hoods and Gothic arches and plain song, but a very, very practical, very organized missionary and pastoral group whose work and identity was nonetheless grounded in a very demanding spiritual life. Ignatius devised a kind of induction program for his new order. It's what we now know as the spiritual exercises. And it's a brief, time-limited workshop, as you might say, a program designed to intensify your awareness of yourself and your awareness of God, designed to make you understand better what your motives are so that you can make proper decisions. So he selects a number of very, very carefully chosen biblical texts and stories and sits you down to think about them as hard as you can. Use your senses, use your imagination, call up the scene in your mind. Think what X would say to Y. Think what you would say. Understand that this story in the Bible is your story. What do you discover if you put yourself into the biblical story? What are the words that come up? It's an astonishing achievement of self-examination and imaginative reworking of your whole approach to life. It's designed for people who are coming to the point where they've got to make a decision, yes or no, about staying with the vowed life. And it's also, famously in the centuries since then, the kind of exercise you undertake if you've got any really big decision coming up. It's a month's work. Ignatius allows that there can be slightly abbreviated versions for busy people, but essentially, it's not meant to be a lifetime's guide for how to say your prayers. It's specifically, as I said, a workshop in self-awareness. And some of the confusion that occasionally surrounds it, I think, derives from the fact that not everybody sees it as belonging in that context, doing that job. And some have treated it as if it were the be-all and end-all of spiritual life, as if you never did anything else except meditate on Bible stories in that rather focused way. Because Ignatius assumes that what you'll be doing for most of the time is very much what the older monks and nuns have been doing. That is, you'll be receiving God's goodness. You'll be thanking God for who he is. You'll be contemplating. And that's why he and his order found themselves very close to the other great reforming group of the century, who at first sight seemed to be offering a very different package. Ignatius's new order spread rapidly and spread very widely in the land of Ignatius's birth in Spain. And of course, Spain was the setting where the other great reform was taking place. The brothers and sisters of the Carmelite order, originally an order of hermits in the Middle East that had transplanted to Europe in the Middle Ages, the brothers and sisters of this order were going through quite a crisis in the middle of the 16th century. Like other orders, they'd become a bit complacent and a bit easygoing. As in other orders, people from high social strata had special privileges in their monasteries. You could bring your own domestic servants with you when you entered some convents and get them to cook your meals and clean your room and brush your shoes. Unfortunately, for the complacent brothers and sisters of that era, they were about to be hit by one of the greatest bombshells of Christian history. Her name was Teresa. Teresa de Cepeda y Ahumada, otherwise known as Santa Teresa de Jesus, Saint Teresa of Jesus, the great reformer of the Carmelite order and one of the greatest ladies in the whole of Christian history. Teresa cut through all the fuss, pomp, self-importance, and coziness of the monastic life of her era and restructured her order into small houses, a dozen or so sisters, where you could actually know the people you were praying with and where everybody did the washing up. She's very insistent on this. They were not to have big buildings. They were not to take generous endowments from local aristocrats. They were to be poor. And she says wonderfully in one of her works, "If you start building large monasteries, all I can say is I hope they fall on you." A very typically Teresian line. Now, Teresa had come to this in middle life. She'd been a sort of cozy, rather self-satisfied nun for quite a lot of time, and she'd rather lost sight of the tremendously exciting and transforming experiences she'd had as a young woman as she first entered the order. Then in her 40s, something comes over her again. This is unreal. This is not good enough. We've got to do this better. We've got to break down the stereotypes and start again. But in addition to all the extraordinary energy that she put into reforming the order, she was the terror of bishops, archbishops, cardinals, and grand inquisitors. In addition to all that, she put colossal energy into her writing. She wanted to tell people what it was like. And she offers us two structures for understanding the life of prayer and the growth of the spirit. The first of these you'll find in her autobiography. This was written at the suggestion of her confessors and spiritual directors, and it got her into terrible trouble with the Inquisition, who confiscated the manuscript, and it disappeared for over a decade until she appealed to the King of Spain to get it back for her. She was that sort of woman. In the life, in the autobiography, she gives us four stages of prayer. Think of a garden, she says. Gardens need watering. Now, the first thing you can do if you want to water a garden is to go to the tap with a bucket or a watering can and walk back and pour it out. Fine, you know, the water gets to the soil, but it needs a lot of work. What about thinking through it again? What about irrigation? What about a water wheel? That's a good idea. You can train streams to go through and get a water wheel to keep it going. Right, that's an improvement. Dig some ditches and have a system to it. Right, that means the water's getting there a bit more efficiently and there's less work involved. And what's the best method of irrigation of all? Rain. And fortunately or unfortunately, there is absolutely nothing you can do to make it rain. You are not involved at all. The rain and the soil meet. Well, she says, that's what our growth in the life of prayer is like. At the beginning, we are cranking away, either pulling stuff up from the well or turning, getting the water wheel turning. We are very much involved. We work. But as time goes on, we realize that the most successful way for this to happen is rain. And we get used, instead of cranking the wheel and hauling the bucket all the time, we get used simply to saying, come on, rain, in your own time. Because that is how the soil will really get soaked and stuff will really begin to grow. That's prayer, getting yourself ready for rain. You need to work just to get yourself into the spirit of it. You need those early difficult stages. There's no way around it. But the climax is when you can just say, rain, please. Now, some years later, she wrote another book called The Interior Castle. And in this, she gives a much longer and rather more sophisticated account of our movement towards maturity. And instead of the four stages that she mentions in the life, that is the bucket, the water wheel, the irrigation ditch, and the rain, she's got seven stages. Run through them very quickly. We begin just saying our prayers. We say the stuff in the book, we say the things that come into our minds, fine. But that's a bit mechanical. So we move on to stage two, if we're serious. When we've really been converted, then we're aware of our sins, we're asking for God's mercy as if we really mean it, and we're being quite active in our devotion. We're looking for more things to do and deeper experience. And that leads on to a third stage, where we're actually doing rather well. We've got our spiritual lives pretty well organized. We go on our retreats, we have our daily quiet time, we do our Bible study. We're doing okay, and we're, Teresa says again very typically, and we're very free with our good advice to other people at this point. Now that's the transitional phase, which is really risky, because that's the point at which you can get stuck. And the worst thing that can happen is that you get stuck being a highly successful, professionally religious person. And actually, she says, nobody really gets stuck. What really happens is that you slip back. So you're poised at the end of stage three. Either you're going to take the risk of moving on, or you're going to slither back. Well, with God's help, you may be enabled to take a step in the dark. and to let God into this well-organized religious life. In stage three, you can be so busy being religious that nobody would ever believe there was a God out there somewhere who actually had something to do with this. But in stage four, God is allowed in, and he begins to break up the carefully constructed life that you've made for yourself. He begins to be a nuisance. He begins to nudge at your will and your desires, your deepest feelings, so that you're aware that actually your self-will is rubbing up against God. Your intellect, your understanding, is struggling. You don't know what's going on. More and more you have to shrug your shoulders and say, God, I've no idea what's happening. Are you still there? Because I think I'm still here. And at best, there's a kind of dumb silence and passivity, what one other writer memorably called the prayer of stupidity. We just say, I haven't a clue. Okay, I haven't a clue. It's over to you now. And that's when prayer begins to move onto the God side rather than the you side. And it may be after years and years and years, you move on. God draws you on to a deeper sense of assurance. He tells you he's not going to let go of you. Stage five. And in stage six, your inner life has got to the stage where it's stripped down to a deep receptivity, content, patient, eager, confident, and yet totally open. Which leads to stage seven, which is union, the spiritual marriage. And that doesn't mean, stage seven, unbroken ecstasies. It means actually that you are now at home with God in every moment, in every aspect of your life, however prosaic and domestic. The highest stage of spiritual maturity for Teresa is not floating 6 inches off the ground with your hands clasped and your eyes turned heavenward while angels pour balm on your head. It's actually, and she says this, it's actually doing the washing up in a calm, full awareness of God, because you've arrived. Heaven and earth have come together. Mary and Martha, she says, have joined hands. Action and contemplation are no longer different. Well, it's a wonderful bit of diagnosis. And what we need to remember is that most people spend most time in stage four, if they're lucky. Don't be under any illusion about the ease or brevity of this. But that's the point where you really need good advice, good direction, reliable Christian friends around. A couple of other things that she says are worth remembering. One is, interestingly, don't let go of the humanity of Jesus. Don't imagine that somehow the more exalted you get in your spiritual life, the more you can forget about reading the Gospels. Jesus matters, because the whole thrust of this story is incarnation. It's about coming down to earth. It's about being where you are, only with the awareness of God glowing in every moment and action. Incarnation. So the human Jesus matters. And in case you find it difficult to remember that, says Teresa, well, for goodness sake, do something practical. Carry a picture of Jesus in your pocket and take it out from time to time. Remember he's there. And remember, you're there. Teresa had a great inspirational influence on her order. And she inspired particularly a number of brothers of the Carmelite order, particularly an extremely shy, very small and quiet and profound and rather complicated chap called Juan de Yepes, better known to history as St. John of the Cross. He may be a little chap, said St. Teresa, but he's tall in the eyes of God. John of the Cross was one of the relatively few people that Teresa really trusted. She didn't always understand him, and he didn't always understand her, and she occasionally makes fun of him, as she makes fun of pretty well everybody. But for a crucial period of several years, John is chaplain to Teresa's new reformed convent in Avila, and the two of them talking more or less every day. And so when St. John writes his great treatises on the life of the Spirit, he is building on some of what Teresa says, but taking it in new directions. He is interested in the whole story as a process of conversion at every level of the human constitution. What's going on in the life of prayer is that our memory, our understanding, and our will are each one of them being turned inside out and turned towards God. God needs to be the object of our memory, the object of our understanding, and the object of our will and our desire. And that means that the whole process is about our attachment to the things of this world gradually being loosened so that God can come in. Now, the trouble is, of course, that we don't like to be detached, whether in memory, understanding, or will, from the things that make us feel good. So, the process is a process in which there is a profound letting go that will feel very costly and very painful. And I suppose John of the Cross is remembered chiefly for talking about dark nights. We go through a dark night of the senses, our external identity, and a dark night of the spirit. The dark night of the senses is the way in which, bit by bit, we loosen our grip on the things that make us comfortable. But the dark night of the spirit is where even the things that we thought were religious and edifying and so forth are taken away, and where God gets to work on us. And that means a blackness, a darkness in which nothing in us seems to see anything or relate to anything, anything we can grasp. We are, in one of his images, held in midair. We don't know what to think, what to feel, what to hope for. And it's deeply painful. And all of that is designed to warn us against imagining that prayer is about having tidy outcomes, answers straight away to our petitions, pleasant experiences. That's not going to happen if we're serious. But, he says, don't panic. That might be a summary, really, of John of the Cross's words. Don't panic. When everything is going really badly, that's fine. If you can't make sense of what's going on in prayer, great. If you don't know what to say or think about God, you're getting it. And he builds up these paradoxes very boldly. It's a strategy and a discipline for going through times not just of dryness and boredom, but something deeper than that, a kind of existential emptiness. And it's not completely unlike Luther and Calvin, where I began. When Calvin talks about killing your faith, I think John of the Cross would have understood it. What you think is faith, and what you think is love, and what you think is hope, they've all got to go. But isn't this appallingly negative and frightening? Well, frightening, yes. But the point is that if we are stuck with what makes us comfortable, what makes us feel safe and religious, if we're stuck with that, we're stuck in a lie. And we're stuck with less than reality. God wants our hearts to expand to the full range of his truth and his love. And if we really want reality, with all the unimaginable fulfillment that means, then the only way is by the stripping down of what makes us feel, for this moment and the next moment, cozy and happy. John is not, in spite of the textbook caricatures, John is not somebody who thinks it's good for you to be miserable. And his depiction of what it might be like if we arrive on the far side of all this is unforgettable. It's like George Herbert. My beloved is the mountains, the streams running down their sides. My beloved is the mysterious islands at the end of your journeys. Because on the far side of all this, you see, once again, glory in ordinary things. But to get to that glory in ordinary things, you've got to let go of everything. God wants you to rejoice in truth, in life, in reality. And because we are so habituated to unreality, it's very hard work. And that sets the tone for quite a lot of the spiritual writing of the 17th century, especially in France. And because French is so much more friendly and elegant a language than Spanish, the French writers tend to be much more suave and attractive. And if you want to read St. John of the Cross without the kind of parental guidance bits of St. John, you know, the really frightening bits, you could do a lot worse than read writers like Bishop Francis de Sales, Bishop of Geneva, Calvin's own city. François de Sales gives you pretty much what St. John is talking about, with a wonderful kind of French gloss. You can read an awful lot of Francis de Sales without realizing that he's actually just as scary as St. John of the Cross, only he's being very French about it. It's all about accepting this situation, here and now, as God's will, remembering God in every moment, remembering that it doesn't have to be successful or happy for it to be God's will, but that in accepting every moment, patiently and lovingly, you will actually be coming into the joy of the truth. And in even simpler language, the Carmelite brother Lawrence writes about the practice of the presence of God. An uneducated lay brother in a Carmelite monastery writing in a very Teresan way about finding God in the washing up. And that's a tradition going right forward in the Carmelite order into the 20th century. And although it's slightly cheating to squeeze her in tonight, I have to mention St. Thérèse of Lisieux, the beginning of the 20th century, that greatest of 20th century Carmelite saints, who recommends to us the little way. She died in her 20s of tuberculosis, having been a nun since the age of 15. She wrote diaries, journals, and letters in which she repeatedly says, "Look, I'm not a mystic, I'm not a giant, I'm not a theologian. All I know is I've got to accept day by day what God does. It's a small enough thing. Just do it. It's a little way for little people." And you read Thérèse and think, little people? Heavens. Thérèse again does it in French. And so a lot of people, I think, find her more accessible than John of the Cross. But it's the same message. And the great Thomas Merton, about whom I'll speak tomorrow night, describes his own first encounter with Thérèse, saying, after a while, when you've read this unbelievably cloying account of 19th century French bourgeois life and these rather spoiled little girls growing up in a devout Catholic family and going to the local convent for the odd day out, you think, oh, and then you realize actually what she's talking about is the dark night of the soul and the carrying of the cross and the scraping out of everything you thought you were sure of so that God can come in. And to read what Thérèse was writing in the last months of her terrible final illness, you see that whatever she is, she is only little in the sense that John of the Cross was. So, just summing up very rapidly, three things that come out from the 16th, 17th century era, from both bits of the Reformation divide. First, a colossal stress on the majesty and mystery of God, whether it's Calvin talking about God's majesty or Teresa repeatedly referring to God in Spanish as Su Majestad, His Majesty. Majesty and mystery, the overwhelming glory of God and the power of God. And going with that, of course, a stress on the fact that it is God always taking the initiative in grace and in prayer. But the second thing coming out of that is an intense pastoral attention to our own states of desolation, unhappiness, and confusion in the spiritual life. If the focus is the glory and the splendor and the mystery of God, what's happening in here becomes a bit less important. And what's happening in here is really just the result of trying to get the proverbial quart into the pint pot. Our insides, spiritually, are very small, and their capacity is limited. When God's majesty begins to bear down upon us, something's going to break. Get used to it. Be ready for it. Because the breakage is the beginning of life. And the third thing, which again crosses the Catholic Reformed boundary, is that the goal of all this is an unself-conscious mindfulness of God in ordinary circumstances. Protestants and Catholics alike see the goal of the spiritual life as being, as I put it earlier, doing the washing up in a full and calm and confident awareness of God's reality throbbing in everything. Taken for granted, this is a whole world of self-discipline and sacramental life and Bible reading and vocal prayer. But what's new, building on what comes from the early church, what's new is, I think, above all, this deep pastoral concern for helping people through those periods where the breakage is most painful. And that, I think, is the most important legacy of the 16th and 17th century era for our thinking today about prayer. How do we cope when it's not making any sense? When we feel worthless, confused, left behind by it all? These are the people to go to for help.